The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to the Aquarius Podcast. I'm your host, Randy Reed. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Aquarium Co-op, the premier online destination for live aquarium plants. With a terrific selection of plants, Aquarium Co-op is sure to have exactly what you're looking for, and a whole lot of plants you never knew you needed. From Bacopa, Vallisneria, Scarlet Temple, Floating Christmas Moss Balls, which if you've never seen before, please go to aquariumcoop.com and check them out. They're awesome and super fun. Aquarium Co-op has Crip Wendi, Wendii, Wendedi, or however you pronounce that one, Amazon Swords, super awesome coconut bridges covered in lush Christmas moss, and again, that's another one that you should check out if you have no idea what I'm talking about. And really, there's just too many great plants to name them all. And while you're there, be sure to pick up some Easy Green all-in-one liquid fertilizer to ensure your plants are getting all the essential nutrients they need to thrive. Now, on to the interview. Today's date is Thursday, April 23rd, 2020. My guest today is Jim Valenzuela. Jim is a member of the Hill Country Cichlid Club. Jim has contributed numerous written articles to Fish Tales, the article for the Federation of Texas Aquarium Societies, which are available to the public. Jim has a passion for West African cichlids and enjoys speaking about them at clubs around the country. So Jim, welcome to the podcast.
Randy, thank you very much for having me. Thank you. I know we scheduled this long ago, but we finally got together today.
Yeah, no, it's been a year in the making, Jim, and I'm very happy. I wish it was under, I guess, better global circumstances, I guess, but nonetheless, two fish nerds can finally come together. One of which has much more knowledge, and you can share that with me, the less knowledgeable fish nerd. So, definitely looking forward to learning more about West African cichlids, because to me, you know, you kind of know of Pelvicromis. And that's really about it. But there's so much more to them, and just kind of doing my research, reading some of the articles that you've done and knowing, you know, talking with Greg Steves, friend of the podcast, two-time guest, friend of the podcast, Greg Steves, that you are very, very knowledgeable on that and you've got some great experiences with them. So very much looking forward to it, Jim.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you. And hopefully I can be able to answer some of your questions intelligently.
So first off, Jim, you are in Louisiana, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So what's
Lafayette, Louisiana? Lafayette, about 100 miles from New Orleans.
All right. We're gonna do what makes excellent podcast audio. I'm gonna pull this up on Google Maps just because I like having that visual reference of where my guests are. So, how are things in Louisiana right now, weather wise? Is it because we're April 23rd right now? We're well into spring.
Actually, the weather's been really nice. For about the last month, we've had a couple severe storms come through already that got pounded a little bit, but we're okay. We're fine.
Nice. All right, so Lafayette, there you are, Lafayette, Louisiana. You're kind of in the southern, south central portion of Louisiana?
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
I assume you have gators around you?
We have tons of gators around
here.
Now that I'm birding a lot, I've never seen so many gators in my life.
Oh my goodness!
In the woods and, oh, they're everywhere.
Should we digress right off the bat and talk about birding and Greg's group birding with friends?
Yes.
Does it just lend itself so well to fish people that tend to have collectoritis? Like birding is kind of a less intensive collectoritis kind of hobby.
But, you know, actually, I have never been into birds, and I've never been into photography. And last year was my first day to go out birding with Greg Steves, and it was in August, and I love this hobby. I'm just crazy about it. I go birding every day, sometimes twice a day.
You know, I honestly have a very, very similar story. So my wife and I, we had bird feeders on our back patio, and we enjoyed seeing We enjoyed seeing the birds, and we did buy one of the, you know, Washington State handbook to your local birds. We liked yes. doing the species identification, and you know, you kind of get the three main species. We got juncos, nuthatches, which are probably my favorite bird, and then some finches, and then a couple very, you know, depending on the season, some other transient birds that are pretty cool, like grosbeaks and whatnot, and some pileated nice. Woodpeckers, which I think those actually stay year round. And then Greg came up right to speak at Greater Seattle Aquarium Society, and I took him out for the day. We did hiking and we did some bird watching, and that really kind of kindled, like, because in the beginning of the day, and he video recorded this for his YouTube channel, but I think I was kind of teasing him a little bit about bird watching, but then towards the end of the hike and even, you know, midway through, I was actually kind of really into it, like, man, where are all the birds at? And unfortunately, this hike wasn't great for the birds, but that really sparked something in me. Because before bird watching, I always thought it was just crazy people that would drive their station wagon, park at the end of they'd park at a wetland, pull out this giant camera at 4 o'clock in the morning and put it on a tripod, and that was it. Like, that's all they would do for like two shots. And it just seemed like a boring activity. But now I don't know, like, it's, there's something about it that I really enjoy. And I think it's kind of speaks to the personality of what inherently draws us to fish keepers and fish rooms. You know, the whole collectoritis aspect of it, the viewing, the experiencing, the connection with nature, all that good stuff. And, you know, it's nice that you don't try to catch the birds and you don't have to practice husbandry, you know, you just get to view them, and the collecting, the collecting is just the photos. And then you easily share those photos.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, I have a similar experience. I happen to be living on a ranch right now. It's a little over 12 acres. So, I get to see so many birds, a lot of woods on the property right here. So, I go birding and I've gotten some really cool birds right off the porch there. So that's been very beneficial for me.
Nice. And so, I think I would encourage any listener that has listened to Greg Steeves and, you know, is a birder as well. I'm going to plug Greg's Facebook group, Birding with Friends. So I'll have a link to it in these show notes. If you want to join the group. And actually, I recently got Jimmy from Aquarium Co-op, who's just an amazing photographer, and he's started doing some birding as well. And so, you know, I invited him to the group, and he's shared his photos, and Jimmy is just an amazing, amazing photographer, amazing videographer, and he's such a wonderful guy. And so, you know, having him now share into that group is pretty cool. And yeah, it's fun.
Yes, it really is. And yes, Jimmy has some outstanding pictures that he posted too. I remember.
He's incredible. I just picked up a new camera, and Jimmy is my guru, my teacher for how can I accelerate to be the best photographer I can in as quick of a time as possible. And I really want to focus on the photography in the fish room, so I can share these pictures of the discus and these new corydoras and all these other fish that I have with social media. You know, inject them into YouTube videos. But also, I was even telling him this morning that I want to use it to just kind of force me to spend more time in the fish room and force me to spend more time with each individual tank as I try to get these shots, as I record video, you know, putting in the tank time, putting in the viewing time to actually observe behavior and really just appreciate and be more in tune with each one of these tanks as I'm trying to photograph it or take video of it.
And you know what, after seeing so many beautiful pictures, fish pictures, it's pretty difficult to do it. I mean, it's not easy at all. And same with the bird situation. It's I find it very hard to get the right picture. I must delete tons more than I actually keep.
It's one of those things that people just make, you know, the people that have put in the hours and hours and, you know, tens of thousands of camera clicks, they just, you know, they're so good at it, they make it look easy. And then when you actually get it in your hands, you're like, wow, I have no idea what I'm doing. And so it's given me such a greater appreciation for what they do. And if you haven't checked out Jimmy's fish photography and his videography on his YouTube, he is amazing. He is absolutely amazing.
I definitely would check that out. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think I've probably lost 3/4 of our listeners by now with this, early podcast digression. But it's a free podcast, so it's all right. So, Jim, so you as a fish keeper, what's your origin story? What are your earliest memories of fish keeping? And, you know, how did you just get into this hobby?
I've been doing fish now for about 45 years. I started when I was 17. I worked a retail shop and had access to fish and wholesale prices and salt water. I've worked at 4 different retail shops, which is not a big deal to me, but my best job probably ever, even 40 years ago, was working at a wholesaler in Southern California. I absolutely loved it there. When I found out that I could go apply, I went over there one Friday. I remember it like it was yesterday. And no one answered the door, and pretty soon this tall man came out, and I was nervous, thinking I was going to have to do an interview. And I did feel like I knew a lot about fish, or a good amount. The guy looked at me, and I said, "Sir, I'd like to work here." And he said, he looked at me and just said, "You can start Monday, 8:30. And that's how I got into it. And it was probably my best job ever, Randy. It was, we were getting fish from all over the world at that time. And we were shipping out, and we delivered to retail stores about 25 per day, 5 days a week. And we shipped overseas as well, and we shipped a lot of fish, rare fish, to Japan. SeaWorld in San Diego bought a lot of the rarer stuff from us.
Oh, wow.
It was really unique, place to work. And they put me on the packing table for a while, and I certainly had an education very, very quick. And I realized how little I did know about fish at that point. It's just really an amazing place to work.
What would you say, so your interest in the hobby, so when you first got into it, were you drawn towards like the freshwater side, the saltwater side? Were you drawn to more tropical fish, or were you inherently drawn to cichlids of some sort?
I was really into the saltwater. And at that time in the late 70s, you know, I lost more than I actually kept, unfortunately. And then I went into freshwater, and I mostly just kept South American bigger fish, arowanas, pacus, that type of stuff, silver dollars, and occasional oddball fish from Africa, and had many tanks at that point as a kid. And I stayed in that type of a hobby for 25, 30 years. I never was involved with any aquarium clubs at that point. I kept fish, and they lasted a long time, and if they died, I bought more fish. And it wasn't until I went to my first fish auction in Houston, Texas, that's when I got hooked up with club and auctions, and I just really fell in love with the actual buying, bidding on fish, and meeting new people. Then I went to the Hill Country, and certainly Greg Steeves and Schumacher were there, Dave Schumacher. And learned a lot from them, and was able to get a lot of fish I'd never even heard about. And they were very helpful in letting me get new fish. And so that's pretty much how I got in the clubs at that point.
Nice. So regarding your time kind of as a solo hobbyist, right, before you made it into the club scene, were you attempting any breeding projects at all, or was it just purely you like these South American fish, you just had a bunch of tanks, and it was, you would just get a fish and just kind of let it live its life, and you would just enjoy those fish and not necessarily try and do any breeding or anything extra on top of just being kind of a general aquarist?
That's exactly what I did, and I feel sometimes I wasted a lot of time because I was just set in my own little box there, kept the same fish, and they lasted a long time, many of them did, and like I said, it wasn't until I got into the clubs and being introduced to so many more cichlids and Africans, and when I was working wholesale, I really didn't care for the Africans at that time. There were just so many of them, and the names are hard to pronounce. And so
it seems like a never-ending stream of African cichlids that are all super colorful, and they either have, you know, they're obviously like a scientific name is going to be crazy in and of itself, but then there's always like a splashy common name on there, and I kind of can get lost a bit in the African cichlids, especially the Rift Lake ones.
This is weird to say, though, but in the late 70s, the African cichlids were coming in so fast, we didn't know the names for them at the wholesale place. The owner's name was, his last name was Stiebel, and there were so many Haplochromos Stiebeli that we put out. We didn't know names, we just put them out, you know. It's sad to say that, but we just didn't have the information like we do nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what was your, you're starting at 17, what was your multiple tank progression, and how did your parents take all that, right, as you start amassing this, collection of tanks, and fairly large tanks by the sound of it?
My parents were fantastic. I used to have a hobby of going to different fish stores, especially in Southern California, and there's a ton of them out there. And I remember Mom and Dad would drive me or go with me, and we hit many fish stores each day. And my room was, I ended up taking out my bed, and it was wall-to-wall aquariums.
That's awesome. So what were you sleeping on? Did you just sleep on the floor?
On the floor, yeah. And then I slowly started bringing bigger tanks in their living room and family room, and they encouraged me. They really did. I look back at that, and they put up with a lot. And or I would buy tanks and set them up, and I'd find someone that would buy the whole setup from me, and they were always disappointed to see the tanks leave, too, and then I'd get new ones, and it was back and forth.
That is amazing. I think your parents need to win, the parental, nurturing aquarist award of the year or something like that for just supporting you and encouraging you. And then the fact here that they would be disappointed when you would sell one of the setups to somebody.
Well, I went to a wholesaler out in Southern California. I can't remember the name of it. It's probably gone by now. But they had little red-bellied piranhas. And the red-bellied piranhas were illegal in California. And I had about 25 of them. And I raised them up to about 7 or 8 inches. And that was sort of a cool tank. I enjoyed that. Piranhas by themselves are no fun, but when you get a bunch of them, they're sort of cool.
Nice. So So we'll follow your progression. Was there ever a point when you didn't have any tanks? Like you had to, you moved, you had to break everything down, and you took a bit of a hiatus from the hobby?
No, I've always had tanks. I moved to Louisiana about 25 years ago, and I bought a fish in Phoenix, because I was living in Phoenix for a while, and I just got rid of that fish, and it was 25 years ago. I'd had that fish. It was a Cynodonis angelicus.
Wow.
But pretty much kept the same fish all the time. And I went into discus a little bit for a while. And like I said, arowanas and approach lotus and oscars and pacoons, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And so I know I kind of prefaced this the intro that you have this big passion for West African cichlids. Is that currently what your fish room, right now, is predominantly dominated with? Or does that only represent, a small portion of it, but you just happen to, really get into those?
Well, due to unforeseen circumstance, I had to get rid of the fish. And I do, as of last week, I picked up some Stomatapia pindu. And I have those outside right now. But all the other fish have been gone, and I was able to give them to different breeders in this area. Hopefully they'll keep them going until I'm able to set up another fish room.
Oh, that's good. And then, so let's talk about, I think, one fascinating thing from this article, and before we get into the actual West African cichlids, this idea that you have, or the fact that you did have an indoor fish room for the wintertime, and then a fairly extended outdoor fish room season. So when did you first start toying around with having tanks outside?
The Louisiana weather is perfect, and I prefer to be outside. So what I would do is I'd in the patio, I set up tanks out there. I had about 30 tanks out there. They didn't have gravel, and I used sponge filters. And I would do massive water changes, massive. I mean, all the way down the bottoms, every day, every other day. And then I fill up water, replace the water. I had a pond there, about a 1,000-gallon koi pond. So it was ideal situation for me. I fed heavy and they bred, and I just enjoyed it outside. It was just perfect spot for me to keep the fish.
So did you have like a friend encourage you to put a tank outside, or you just figured, hey, the weather is great out here, like why not start throwing some tanks out here?
I did. I just decided to put some out there, and a friend of mine came by and said, Jimmy, because there was a couple babies in the pond, and he said, Jim, you ever thought about breeding Africans? I said, oh, no, I don't think so. I never thought about breeding any fish. Well, as soon as he said that, I started looking into it and learning a little bit more, and pretty soon I was stripping and getting a lot of fish from the auctions and raising them up and breeding them and bringing the fry back to the auction. So it didn't take long before I had tons of fry outside.
Mm. Yeah, one of the things, I lived in San Diego for about 3 years from 2000, when was I there? 2010, 2011 to about 2014, and that was when I had left Sacramento. So I was in the hobby when I lived in Sacramento. We moved, completely got rid of all the tanks. And for about a year, we lived in a place that had a nice backyard, had this big, really old established avocado tree, so we were getting free avocados. That was fantastic. And I really I really regret not taking advantage of that year that we were in that rental house with a porch, with a backyard, to set up some outside year-round tanks, because San Diego would have just been so perfect for it.
Perfect.
So that's, you know, if I ever move back there, that's definitely something. Or anywhere that has a climate that has an extended kind of warmish season, I definitely want to do that, because I've seen some videos now of these guys with outdoor fish rooms like yourself with, you know, normal rectangular aquariums on racks outside, and it just looks so amazing. It looks so awesome.
You know, I here in Louisiana, I usually put the fish out around the 15th of April, and then they stay out till about 15th or the end of October. So we have a good season to keep the fish outdoors.
What's your high lows that you look for? So typically, if it's going to be in sometime in April, but what's the high or the low temperature where you're like, okay, yeah, I can start moving them out?
The mornings are a little bit cool, probably in the 40s.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and then. Actually, for the West Africans, they did very well outside. And I mean temperatures with the Pungu. They were hitting 86, 88 degrees, the tanks. And they just bred like hell.
Wow. And I'm sure just the, you know, being, whether they're, you know, getting some form of natural sunlight, their colors are probably just amazing.
Yes, they really were. That was just an awesome fish that I had. I was so lucky to be able to breed that.
And so let's see here. Is that the? Let's go ahead and jump into then your article. So yeah, Punga McLaren and I. So the Fotis Fishtails, Volume 8, Issue 1. So this is, when was this published? July 2018, somewhere around there. So middle of 2018 is when this particular article came out. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. And I mean this particular available online publication from Fotis is just chock full. Every edition of this is so many great lengthy articles, you know, color photos, all that good stuff. So Greg and the rest of you guys at Fotis are doing a fantastic job. But, you know, so it's been a couple years now since you wrote this article. I guess let's start with, I don't know, I'll just let you take it. I'll let you take over. I don't know if we want to start with kind of what you understand of Lake Baromba Mumba, or just let you roll with it.
Let me start off. We were at the Hill Country, and they were going to do a swap meet out there. That's where people buy tables, and then they sell their fish and whatever. And I went out there, and there was a retailer from Houston who was there, and he brought 8 fish. And the fish were the Pungu Makarani and the Mayaka Mayaka. I didn't know what they were. I had Greg Steves, I had Charles Jones, and I had Dave Schumacher come up to me, and I had a table set up. I had used to sell a lot of driftwood. And they said, Jim, you ought to think about getting these fish. They're very seldom offered for sale, and they're quite rare. And I said, really? So I looked at the bags. The guy wanted $25 each for them. They were about a 3 or 4 inch fish. That was more than I wanted to pay for fish.
That's a pricey fish.
Yeah. So what happened was, the retailer wanted my driftwood and I wanted his fish, so I guess we didn't really exchange any money. It worked out perfectly for me. I got the fish and drove the 500 miles home and making sure that stopping all the time, checking on them. And I had him put him in a 75-gallon tank in the house. I knew nothing about these fish. I checked on internet. There's very seldom anything about it, very that I could find anyway. I end up finding that Dr. Paul LaSalle had written an article about 20 years prior. And another hobby of mine was collecting aquatic literature, and I literally had 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 pieces of books and magazines. I knew I had the magazine that it was in, I just had to find it in all the boxes there. Once I found the article, I read it, and I just thoroughly enjoyed it, and it seems like Dr. Paul was more... He said that temperature had to be very high to keep these things. And so nothing more. I put the fish outside and nothing happened that first year. The following year when I put them outside again, I was cleaning the tanks and draining all the water and doing the water changes. And I found that my yak and the pungu, when I'm draining the tanks and cleaning the sides, they really freak out. So what I would do is I put the four pungu in a 5-gallon bucket and the four mayaka in a 5-gallon bucket, clean the tank out really good and then refilled it, and I would return the fish back to the tank. When I went to the 5-gallon bucket, I noticed there was fry in the pungu bucket. I immediately took the adults out. I texted Greg Steves and told him about it. He said, "Jim, that's pretty cool. Those things very seldom breed." They were fairly well developed, and I got 26 fry out of it, and it was on the 25th of August, and I was just so happy about it. I end up keeping them for maybe about a month or two, and Hill Country had a rare fish auction, so I decided I was going to take these fish, take six of them over there, and donate them to the club, see what would happen. The auction started, and I think I heard someone bid on $20, and somebody ran up to $30, and these fish were only maybe half inch. They weren't very, very big at all. Then all of a sudden, I heard someone say $100, and I thought, wow, someone got them. I guess they really wanted them bad. But a long story short was I end up losing most of the pungu and the adult breeders through my negligence on feeding. They all came down with bloat, and I had seven left, and talk about, I was so upset.
And so just to unpack the how you lost them on the bloat, we're thinking that, what, too high of protein of a diet?
That's exactly what happened.
Okay.
That's exactly. I called Dave Schumacher, and he said the same thing. He said, "Jim, we got to get more of a vegetable-based diet," so I got some flake food from him. And then what I did is I ended up breeding more fish out of those seven. They grew up, they bred for me, and I end up getting over 200 fry from those seven fish. And the fry have been all distributed to eight different states of the country right now, from California to New York. And that was, I was so happy to send my fry all around the country. Thanks to Dave Schumacher for helping me with the shipping part of it.
That's awesome. What do you think the trigger was to trigger the breeding? You know, because if Greg is saying that these are, you know, typically not bred in captivity very much, and you know, you're just kind of going about your normal, it sounded like your normal husbandry practices for any of the fish that you would keep outside, and just during the course of one of your water changes, it's, oh man, 25 fry, like, ooh, sweet. What do you think it was that triggered it?
Randy, I really think it was the high temperature.
Mm.
I really think also. Lots of water changes. I had a lot of driftwood in the tanks, and I think they would bite the driftwood. I would always find pieces, you know. They have a really hard, strong jaw, I really think that's what did it. It took me months before I could even tell the male and females apart. They looked identical. The other thing is both males and females hold, so that was even more difficult.
Really?
Yes.
That's
so
cool.
Yeah, really. It took, I don't know, just a long time to figure out. I can tell males and females now, but it was very, very difficult in the beginning. And
what are the physical characteristics that for you that that distinguish a male bit from a female in this Punga McLareni?
My opinion is the males are more bulkier. They had darker heads.
Mm.
That was it, mainly those two areas. The females are a lot smaller. I had a female that actually, I didn't know it was a female at the time, the fish I found on the dining room floor, and got it into the tank right away, and as a result, it lost an eye, and that female produced for me a lot of fry. It was a smaller fish, and it just always was holding, so, and then I find that I would, you got to catch these fish at nighttime because they spook too easy. If you catch them during the daytime, the lights are on in the aquarium, they'll spit in the net, and it's just a big mess.
Mm.
Do it at nighttime, and believe it or not, I would use a little blue light in the tank. I would wear a black t-shirt, and there I am catching the female. And I find, for me, it worked better to strip at 13 days. If I do 10 days, they weren't developed enough, for me anyway. And if I waited too long, I was afraid that they were going to spit in the tank. So 13 days was the critical time for me.
Jim, I'm not well versed in, mouth brooders or mouth brooding cichlids and whatnot, and kind of the breeding repertoire, I guess, for that. Is 10 days kind of a standard? Like, oh, if you've got a mouth brooding fish, you typically strip at 10 days? Or is this just from your own experimentation?
Well, what I believe I recall is they recommend around 20 days, 21 days. And then you have some hobbyists, and I know that's a controversy, but where they actually catch the fish and strip them.
Right.
I just prefer that way because I wanted to get a lot of fry. I just, everyone really counted. In fact, I would call Greg up and I'd say, I got 5 fries. And he would go, everyone, it counts. Everyone counts. I think the most I think I had was like 28 or something like that. It was a big brood.
Nice. So let's tie this into the cares aspect of it and why everyone counts. So Lake Burrumbi Mbo.
Mbo.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. I was trying a little too hard on that one. So what do you know about that lake? I've got, again, my favorite activity during a podcast is to have it up on Google Maps. This thing is, in Cameroon, north of the equator, and it's a relatively small lake, smaller than I would have thought. So I will, I'll stop talking and let you talk.
I'll give you a little bit of information I do have. It's a very small lake, I think about an acre. You can actually stand on the shore, and you can look around the entire lake. It's fairly deep, maybe 300 feet, if I recall, but only down to about 150 holds life, if I recall, due to the oxygen level. There's, I believe, 11 species of cichlids that come from that lake that are only found in that lake. I was fortunate enough to get 4 of them, and I bred the Stomatopia pindu, and I had the mongo, Stomatopia mongo as well. I didn't get a chance to breed them until I ended up selling them to another hobbyist due to my circumstance. But I fell in love with this lake. I really did. I don't think they're exporting anything out of that lake at this point. And like most areas in the world, deforestation and pollution and everything else has been very hard on these species.
Yeah, just from what I can tell from the Google Maps perspective, I mean, it is a very circular lake, which, it almost looks like a caldera, like a volcano. It looks like a crater. Is it a crater lake?
It is a crater.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. My my geology 101 is paying off. Randy, the was a volcanologist. So it's
you're absolutely right.
Awesome. So it's a crater lake. It's right outside the city of Kumba, and it looks, from what I can tell, about, is it like a mile wide at most? Maybe less than a mile wide?
Maybe a
half mile wide. Yeah, so it's not, like you say, it's not a very big lake, and it's surrounded by forest. So this I'm assuming extinct volcano. You know, it's got all this green lush around it with some civilization encroaching on from the southeast. But yeah, it just doesn't look like, you know, I mean, when you think of Africa, and of course you think of the Rift Lakes, you know, these just massive bodies of water. And then it's, oh, here's little Lake Barombi with these 13 or 14 endemic species of cichlids. That's really, really cool.
Yeah, it really is. And when I get more tanks again, I'm going to spend a lot more of my effort and time in getting more of these cichlids. I just fell in love with the area. And it's just so cool because they're unique, and they're found nowhere else on Earth. Yes.
Is there any? Is there primarily deforestation? So with deforestation, you get that silt runoff into the water. Is there overfishing? Is there introduced invasive species like now tilapia into this to support an actual food fishery? Are there any of those pressures as well?
I think that's correct.
All of the above.
Yes. I think there was some introduced species that put in that lake as well. And because it's relatively small, it's just, it's just very hard there's not very many of them there.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any bucket list, you know, kind of intentions to put a trip out to Cameroon and to actually go in person to Lake Barombi? Is that an all a desire of yours?
I actually thought about it at one point. Probably not now. I think it's just, but it would be a dream though. It might be a dream just to go there sometime. And I certainly look at some people that have an opportunity to do it, and I see their videos on YouTube, and it's just amazing to see these fish. And I think of, oh, there's a pungu right there. And they really, out of all the fish I kept, I want to say the West Africans are, I fell in love with this, these species.
Mm-hmm. So to kind of go back from your like geographic moving in the United States, so Southern California, Arizona, and then Louisiana, did you struggle at all with like water quality, water parameters, and kind of what you kept? Because from my understanding, Southern California, I want to say that's a fairly high pH and like high TDS water, right? Coming from what, the Colorado River or Mono Lake sometimes, or wherever Los Angeles pulls their water from?
You know, Randy, I really didn't pay that much attention to the pH. I probably should have. In Louisiana, where I was living in my house, to me, the critical thing was just doing the major water changes. And keeping that temperature up. And even when I brought the fish in for the winter, I didn't use heaters in the tanks in the house except for the Barombi bull cichlids. And I would crank that up, like I said, at 86, 88.
Mm-hmm. So you're not chasing any water parameters as far as in your whole time as an aquarist, or trying to match what the riverine or lake-based West African cichlids come from?
No, I really don't.
And I can completely appreciate that, because I am not. I will admit I am not a parameter chaser. It could stem from just being on the lazy side for me personally. But
yeah, you're talking to a guy who doesn't use gravel and just uses sponge filter. So it's
hey, when you've got multiple tanks, man, that's the way to go. I will say with the Corydoras tanks, I am experimenting with just kind of the first quarter portion of the tank having very light covering so they can kind of get that stimulation. But that's for that particular species, you know, that type of fish, where most of every other tank in the fish room is bare bottom. So
yes,
I'm with you on that.
Yeah, I certainly do agree. And the fish that I have outside right now, you couldn't even tell they were in there. They were just in a 55 gallon, and there's boards on top of it, and just an air stone right now, so I got to work on that a little bit.
Nice. And so the actual mechanics of your pulling water from your 1,000 gallon koi pond, And is that like getting pumped into a 55-gallon barrel, and then from there that's getting pumped into the tanks? Like how, or are you just running a pump straight from the pond into these tanks?
That's exactly what I did. Just a pump, and then I would refill the tanks, and then I'd top off the pond. And again, I had unlimited water. I never used chemicals at all in the summertime just because of the situation I was in. But like I said, I would do massive water changes just daily.
No, very cool. And, yeah, I'm trying to see here. Yeah, Cameroon, kind of north of the equator. Looks, yeah, that whole area, like, I really want to go. And I think on my kind of collecting bucket list activities is go to West Africa. Not so much for the cichlids, but I really want to go and do some killifish chasing. I think that would be I think that would be pretty cool to do. What other kinds of fish do you have in your, did you have in your fish room at kind of its height more recently?
It was mainly, I guess you can call them the bread and butter African cichlids is what I kept and raised them. And those all went to auctions and did that for quite a number of years. But I would say really most of the fish I did keep, I know this is different than what I just said right now. They were mostly Karas fish, a lot of Victorians, and mostly Karas species.
Mm-hmm. Were you first introduced to Karas just when you joined that club scene, joining like the Hill Country Cichlid Club and whatnot?
Exactly. Between Dave and Gray, again, very, they taught me a lot about the Karas fish, and that club is definitely goes in that direction, and certainly not any of the hybrids or pretty much against all that kind of stuff. So it was a perfect club for me to be in.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any? Did you ever have any fish in your fish room that gave you a challenge that you just weren't able to breed?
I would say the mayaka. I never did get a chance to breed those. Another fish from the Rambibo. Never had a chance to breed those, and they're a beautiful fish too. They were already up about 5 inches when I let them go, but I wish I would have got to breed them.
Do you have any theories as to maybe what might have happened with them as far as not being able to breed them?
Well, I really don't, and even talking to people around the country, that's a fish that is just very, very difficult. And in fact, I don't even think anyone's breeding them at all right now. Mm-hmm. So it's a very difficult fish.
Yeah, and so in this in your article, what I really like is that you do list the, let's see here.
But I was disappointed that they never did breed for me. Maybe someday I'll get some more and change that.
And how long did you have them for?
Actually, a while, maybe 3-4 years.
Okay, and then so like from a sexual maturity standpoint, they should have been sexually mature by then.
Yes, they were. The males were, you know, they are all fired up at different times, and they chase each other all the time. And I just never could get anything out of them. Huh. I really
interesting.
Yeah, disappointing a little bit.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure you've got enough successes in your fish room that, you know, doesn't weigh you down too much, but it's like that unicorn, right? It's the one that got away, and the one that, you know, you're gonna when you get your fish room, you know, back to where you want it to be, then, you know, that'll be one that you can go after again.
Yes. In fact, you brought up a bad memory right now.
Uh-oh.
I forgot about it, and now it's bugging me. I need to get some more of them. But it's one of those fish that it's almost impossible to get. They're just not available. That's why I was so lucky to get those from that guy from Houston. And I did find out at one of the FOTOS meetings from that time, his name is Prosper. I don't know his last name, but he has a retail store in Houston. But I said, were those wild caught? And he says, oh, most definitely. So that was sort of cool to be able to breed the wild caught ones.
And you do know somebody that does have the mayaka, right? And were they the from your population?
No, they weren't. They're from a guy has them up in New England area.
Oh, okay.
So a different source, I would imagine.
That's such a wild aspect of this hobby that. You know, these West African fish that we're talking about that are endemic to only, you know, they're endemic to a lake in Cameroon, and we're Americans, you know, it's a Seattle guy talking to a Louisiana guy who's talking about a fish that he knows a guy in New England has. Like, it's just, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's where that CARES program really helps out a lot. And especially the internet, we share information and posting pictures and posting breeding and all that. That really helps a lot. And that's how, once I started posting pictures, I had people contact me that they wanted my fry. So that was sort of cool. You know, 20 years ago, that didn't happen, or 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Greg, you know, when I originally had him on, it was to talk about the CARES program. And is it a quarterly publication that CARES puts out? And at the end of it, I think it has the CARES exchange list of what various people that have CARES species, they listed up.
Yes.
Okay. Is it monthly or quarterly?
I think it's quarterly. Okay. Yes.
And then another resource is always AquaBid, right? You can always, you know, you can search CARES. I've done that a couple times to see what comes up. And, you know, the onus is obviously going to be on the seller to actually include that it's a CARES species, whether they put it in the title or the description so it actually comes up. It'd be kind of neat if actually AquaBid would have a specific, maybe just a drop down like in their little menu for CARES specific, yeah. And then it would just be all encompassing regardless of the type of fish that it is.
That would be really nice. And actually I got a lot of my CARES fish from the club. That was so cool, to be able to get fish from the breeders and certainly you can get information about those fish. And, it made my job a lot easier trying to acquire some of these rare cichlids.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very cool. Well, Jim, this has been a fantastic conversation. I mean, learning about these West African cichlids and especially the Punga McLarenii and just your experience with them, I've definitely appreciated it. Where do you see yourself in the hobby in the next like 5 years?
Well, it's funny you say that because I had been trying to get out of the hobby for years, probably about 5 years. And it's a big joke with all the clubs in Texas and Louisiana. They said, oh, yeah. They even made a shirt for me. I'm downsizing the country. And they had several people that were wearing the shirt with a picture of me in the front. I slowly got rid of everything, anticipating the move, and that happened. And I've been without fish for about 6 months now. It's the first time in my life, I recall, since I first started. I really would like to find a place where I'm able to set up a fish room again and focus on the CARES fish and the cichlids from Burundibo. Possibly, maybe that will happen maybe within the next year. But I didn't realize how much I would miss the fish. And certainly the birding has taken... has helped me a lot, but I still miss the fish, though.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, because again, you know, to bring up Greg again, his ears are probably burning right now, but, you know, he himself, we talked about him kind of downsizing, and it seemed like birding was taking, not that it was taking more time, but he was finding kind of a new interest in that, and, you know, him downsizing his fish room and really focusing on a few select fish, you know, to kind of hear that you guys are both, you know, going through that, you executing on that more so than he has, and then to hear that you're like, oh man, I've been 6 months without him, and I actually kind of miss him.
Yeah, it's sort of funny, because all we do is we talk about birds. We never talk about it. It's funny.
when you do start, building up your fish room again, do you think, will you take the approach of maybe just one or two species, really narrow it down, only have a few tanks, or do you think it would just end up being kind of mirroring what you have had before in terms of the number of tanks, the number of species?
Depending on the size of fish room I might be able to have, that would determine that. But I like to focus on the Burundibo cichlids. Again, I really was happy doing that. And being introduced to those species, it created a really huge interest for me in the fish hobby. I think I was probably getting staled after a while, you know, just same fish, 25 years. And it really helped me a lot. And I certainly learned a lot. But I think I'm going to go back in that direction and concentrate more on those particular species.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you think about it, it kind of makes sense that this has been, if fish keeping has been such a, you know, a long-standing part of your life, you know, 45 years total in the hobby, you know, to go even 6 months without it, I would like that. you know, that's just kind of a piece of who you are, you know. And if I'm in the same boat as you, I would have to imagine that, you know, just keeping fish, I've been doing it for so long, and even if it's just one tank, I feel like I'll always probably have to have at least one tank going. As cool as birding is, right? Like, it's, you know, yeah. you get the photo, but then you don't necessarily get to feed the birds, you don't get to really interact with them, you don't get to breed and share the birds, although I'm sure some people probably do in some capacity. Maybe there's a, like Tiger King, there's a bird king out there somewhere.
Yeah.
that'll be the next Netflix show. I was actually wondering, to completely digress on that topic, if Netflix is going to find like some type of like fish king where there's a personality that's equally as interesting as Joe Exotic and Carol Baskin and that whole thing, and it's all about like the tropical fish industry, and it paints us in the same light as like the big cat trade or something. That would be wild.
That is too cool. That's too cool. You know what, Randy? I would like to mention about me actually getting to meet Dr. Paul LaSalle.
Oh, absolutely.
And I was telling him all about it. One day we were having breakfast with Greg Steves, and I went on and on about the pungu, and he interrupted me, and he said, "Do you have fry?" And I go, "Yes, sir, I certainly do." Then, I got so much information from him at that point, you know. And he's been a tremendous help. In fact, I was happy enough, I was able to send him some of my fry, so hopefully he's doing well with them. But he, like I said, he bred them 25 years ago, and hopefully, it was a big honor for me to send him my fry.
I was going to say, that is pretty awesome to actually send Paul LaSalle some fry that he actually wants. Like, that's, yes. Like that's a pretty big feather in your cap.
Yes.
Yeah, Dr. LaSalle.
There were some other fish that he wanted from me too, and that's what Dave Schumacher knew I had him, and so I said, "Well, let me send the pungu too." So it worked out good for all of us, I think.
That's so crazy. Yeah, Dr. Paul LaSalle, that's definitely somebody that I've interacted, and I know people that that know him very well, and so, you know, hopefully someday, whether it's in person or through you know, some type of a virtual manner like this, I can have Paul LaSalle on the podcast and just kind of understand, you know, who he is, and just really his whole origin story. Because I've watched numerous presentations that Paul LaSalle has given, and I mean, just the amount of fish knowledge, geopolitical knowledge for the various areas where he does his work. I mean, the guy's a walking encyclopedia, and not just in fish, but in so many other aspects.
Oh, he really is. Yeah, he goes over my head so many times in a conversation. I have to ask, what does that mean? What does that mean? You know, it's...
Yeah, and he has, awesome. During his presentations, he has a very distinct kind of humor, and when he injects his humor into his presentations, I really appreciate it. It's pretty funny.
Yes.
Well, Jim, this has been fantastic connecting with you. You know, it's been a year in the making, but I'm so glad we had this chance. And, you know, we're helping to put some spotlight on Lake Barombi Embo. Embo.
Embo, yeah.
Man, okay. Maybe if I say it 17 times in this podcast, in this interview, I'll eventually have it. But I would strongly encourage, you know, listeners to just do Google Maps, check it out, you know, see everything that we were talking about. And if you have an interest in cares in general, West African cichlids, you know, and you want to take a crack at Mayaka Mayaka or any of these other species, you know, I hope that this has maybe inspired you, or at least given you a glimmer of education on the lake and the endemic species there.
Well, thank you, Randy, very much for having me, and I certainly hope that your listeners receive some information that they can use, and perhaps maybe they can set up a tank and they can keep some of these awesome cichlids.